Hi, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast in partnership with Help Musicians. Help Musicians is a charity that's been helping musicians for 100 years, supporting music creators of all genres across the UK. Whether it's mental health support, training or mentoring, or supporting new projects, Help Musicians have always been there to lean on, and none more so in the last year during various lockdowns. In this episode, I'll be joined by Billy Bragg, a man who's taken politics into the charts, collaborated with Kirsty MacColl, Kate Nash, and Ian McLagan, and he's written a book on skiffle. That's amazing. Please welcome Billy Bragg. Billy, it's lovely to see you, and thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. Not another bloody podcast is what I say. There's so many of them, I don't know where they stop and where they start.
I'm desperately trying to resist. I've just recorded an album and sitting down with the record company with their ideas, what we should do. Of course, one of their ideas was a freaking podcast.
I was like, podcast and drift, I think, are the things at the top of the list.
Get me behind me. Yeah, there's so much catfighting about there, isn't there, that we didn't used to have to do in the old days. Or you just had to do a peel session and see off the music papers.
It's much easier. Much easier.
It didn't seem at the time, though, did it? It seemed like very incredibly onerous. I pity the poor little fellas around these days. I mean, my son's a musician. He's not in a band now, but he was in a band, and he was always getting grief about doing his socials, you know. It's like, watching him, I was like, it's kind of like homework. It's like going to college again and getting having to hand in your homework every week. It's dreadful. That's not what we signed up for, is it?
Not really, no. When you're a lad, what was it like for you living at home? What was the thing that sort of got your fire burning?
Oh, I suppose, you know, wanting to have my voice heard. Today, I suppose I'll just get myself a Twitter account. But then, and we're talking about in the mid-70s, for someone from my background, a working-class background, I hadn't been to university, I left school when I was 16, the only medium available to me, if I wanted to say something about the world, was to learn to play guitar, write songs and do gigs. There was no other platform out there. So the kid next door, I heard the kid next door playing through the wall, playing his way through the Rod Stewart songbook. So I kind of snuck over the back garden fence and he showed me G, C, E minor and D and off we went.
What did your bedroom look like?
Well, it's a very good question. It had a load of posters on the wall. I had a Saturday job in a hardware store in Barking opposite the railway station. I had a record store in the basement. One of those kind of old style stores where the front of the shop was the dad's business and then the son had started another shop, originally at the back of the shop, and then he took over the whole basement. So the money that I earned in the hardware shop and the Saturday job, I spent in the record shop, and that would either be on vinyl, mostly vinyl, but also on posters as well. So I had a very fine collection of large posters on my bedroom wall. And if the top of my head, I think I had... I definitely had Simon and Garfunkel. I had Bob Dylan. I had the Easy Rider motorbike.
Yeah.
I had the Marx Brothers.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And I may have had Olivia Newton-John as well.
Oh, that exactly. Evokes memories, doesn't it?
There's three words to conjure with.
So you didn't have the tennis player, the female tennis player with the ball up her pants?
No. I did have Brigitte Bardot looking rather sultry on the back of the door so Nan wouldn't see it. So when she came in the room, the door swung open, she wouldn't see it. But who else did I have? I had kind of little bits I used to cut out of magazines. I had a wanted poster for John Wesley Harding. I was a bit of a Dylan fan at the time. Yeah. I had a poster of Bowie with a saxophone from his pin-ups period. Slade, I had a picture of Slade. I also had a picture of Winston Churchill with a Tommy gun.
Wow.
Which I really liked. I really just liked it as an image. And obviously the statuary Bruce Lee.
Of course.
Who else?
And do you have any of those things still?
Yeah, I have them all rolled up in storage.
In storage?
Yeah. I've just moved out, so almost all my stuff is currently, all that sort of stuff anyway, is currently in storage while we're trying to work out where we're going to put it in the new place because we've downsized, so.
Right. When was the last time you were in your old neighbourhood?
Oh, well, not so much. My mum passed away 10 years ago. So right. Going back there has not been such a regular thing. But my brother still lives there. My brother still lives about a mile, 2 miles from where we grew up. And the house we grew up in, my nephew lives in it now. My brother inherited the house when my mum passed away, and my nephew lives there. And when I went over to Barking to see him, I used to go and sleep in his spare room, which had been my old room, which had been the room with the posters in it. But I felt a bit like I was being the kind of sad lodger. I can imagine, because the other thing is, in the middle of the night, you can't get up there and have a wee without every single floorboard
creaking. Yeah.
It's one of those creaky old, you know, the bathroom light goes goodunk when you put it on, you know, and if you don't flush it up. And I could just imagine his missus laying in bed saying, how long are we going to have to put up with this old bastard creeping around here? So I felt bad about it. And in the end, I had a second daughter, and that's her room now. So I kind of... Yeah. Don't stay there anymore. But I do get over there semi-regularly. Just before lockdown, it was the 60th birthday of the guy who taught me to play guitar, Wiggy, who was in a band with me called Riff Raff in the back rooms in the 70s. And we all got together and done a 60th birthday party gig playing the old songs at Dingwalls, to really just for our mates, really. It wasn't really a gig in the gig sense. Right, I put the word out among the Bragg faithful if they wanted to come. But it's really more like a party. And so I was over there. I was over there rehearsing with Wiggy and the rest of the guys for a while. And it also coincided with another friend of mine. With he's kind of like once a month or once every couple of months, get together with the guys we went to school with. So I went along to that as well, which was really interesting because a lot of them I hadn't really seen since I left. So I saw the guy who organised it, Paul Page. I'd seen him. He's almost like a relative, Paul. Our parents were very close. Our mums were very close. And, you know, he comes along to my gigs sometimes. But the rest of the guys that I went to school with, I hadn't really seen some of them since we left school in 1974. So that was cool to sort of sit down and see what they were up to. And that was... Although the terrible thing was when I arrived, I thought, if Paige isn't there, am I going to be able to recognise... any of the other guys? So I walk in, I'm going to look around, and it's just a load of 60-year-old blokes in the pub.
I know that one.
Fortunately, Pagey was at the bar. Where else would he be? And he was like, hey.
Yeah.
And so for that evening, I reverted to Stevens. That's my first name, Stephen. William is my middle name.
Were your parents supportive of you wanting to play music and be in a band?
Yeah, they were supportive in the sense that they let us play in the back room. My parents were really into ballroom dancing to the extent that they would go out, most Saturdays, they would go out to a social somewhere, often to do with my brother's swimming club.
That's a strange mix.
In the Barking swimming club. Well, they, you know, it's kind of a social thing, the swimming club. There are other things they went to. Anyway, most Saturday nights they were out, so everybody would come around our house, put the drum kit on the concrete floor where the extension was, and the amps on the normal one. And the next-door neighbours didn't complain, because if we weren't playing there, we'd have been next door in Wiggy's house, making a racket in his dad's back room. So the neighbours never said anything. We had a park behind us and an alley the other side. So by their absence, they left me the space to find my sort of creative identity, I suppose. And they were supportive. My dad died in 1976, so he didn't really see me gigging or performing. But, you know, my mum used to drive us, probably to get us out of the bloody back room, she used to drive us to our rehearsal space in the car. She was the only one of the parents who had a car. And she would drive us to the school where we rehearsed and come pick us up again. So, yeah, very supportive. Although a little bit disappointed. My mum was a little bit disappointed in me.
Why would that be?
Well, she once told a documentary maker who was making a documentary about me on camera with me sitting there that... the school would let her to expect more.
Oh, I had that as well, funnily enough.
Yeah, so I'm like, you know, she's sitting there surrounded by gold records.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I felt somehow I'd let her down, I suppose, a little bit.
Oh, I don't know if you did. I mean, I remember my parents saying, you don't want to be in the music game, son. Yeah. You know, you'll end up an alcoholic, a drug addict and skint.
Yeah.
And of course, they were right, you know.
Yeah.
But you're not going to listen when you're 16 years old.
No, of course you're not. And, you know, and she would say things like, you know, I never know where you are. That's why I don't like it. And I used to think to myself, well, why worry about that? But now I have them same thoughts about my son, so.
How old's your boy?
He's 27, 28.
Right.
Yeah, and he's the band he was in split up, but he's doing open mics and stuff now. He's still writing, still doing a bit of recording. Obviously, the lockdown's put everything sideways for us all. But yeah, he's hanging in there.
When did you first connect with the songwriter within you?
Well, I wrote a poem when I was 12, you know, in just in a school lesson where we had to write a poem, and I wrote this poem. And the teacher sent a letter home to my parents to ask if I'd copied it from a book, which I hadn't. Then I got to read it out on the local radio station, Radio Essex. And I thought, well, this is Andy. I wonder if this is something, you know, I could do. And I kind of carried on, you know, writing songs. Even before I learned to play guitar, I was writing songs and just keeping the melodies in my head. And, of course, Wiggy teach me to play guitar. That was a huge step forward. And then I failed all my O-levels apart from English language, which I figured is the songwriter's O-level.
It is.
Got a grade A in that, so I thought, maybe this is my gig.
Very similar for me too. I mean, I used to write poetry, and it only takes one teacher, doesn't it, to sort of pick your poem up and say, this is actually really good.
It does, just a little bit of encouragement. And I mean, the only thing that's different to me and all those lads I met down the pub, you know, last year, was they stopped writing poems and I didn't. I don't know why they stopped, but I kept on going and kind of tried to imagine myself in a situation where I could make a living doing it. That's the real trick, isn't it? It's kind of like that bit where you give up your shitty day job and manage to start making a living. I think that's the hardest thing to ever do in music and other entertainment
professions. What were one of your very early ambitions?
Well, my ambitions were really simple, really. And the great thing about my ambitions, Chris, and this is really crucial, is that I shared them with the kid next door. We shared those ambitions. We supported each other. You know, we didn't have girlfriends. We didn't have cars. We weren't good at football. We couldn't box. We didn't go out drinking all the time. But we supported one another in our dream to make an album, tour America, and be on the front of the NME. Those were the things that we, from the back room, my mum's back room in Barking, those were the things that we imagined ourselves doing.
God, that's exactly what Squeeze was like when we first formed. We couldn't do anything else other than have the ambition to go to America, write songs, drink beer, and have lots of fun, of course.
And that didn't happen for my little band. It all fell apart and everything. But in 1984, I got an opportunity to go to America for the first time, opening for Echo and the Bunnymen. And they said, you can sit on the back of the bus. It's coast to coast. You can sit on the back of the bus and you can bring a roadie. So I rang up Wiggy and I said, listen, Wiggs, you've got to come to America with me because this might be the only time I ever go to America. And I am not going to spend my time traveling around America, sending you postcards, places that we talked about going. You have got to come with me. And bless him, he did come with me, sat on the back of the bus. We did it coast to coast. And at the very end, after the tour ended, the Bunnymen had gone home. We were there, our flights were another few days. We checked into some cheapo hotel, the Tropicana, and rented a car. And we drove to the end of Route 66, which is Sunset Boulevard, to the coast, to the ocean. And we watched the sun go down. We paddled in the Pacific Ocean. And there was a moment on that beach, it's very strange, Chris, there was a moment on that beach where we kind of somehow connected with our teenage selves. There was just a moment there where we realised that we'd done that thing that we dreamed of doing. It was a really special moment. And I'm so glad Wiggy was there to share it with me. And as we came off the beach, we saw on the promenade there was an English pub. We were like... this is it, we're going to... And it wouldn't let us in because we didn't have ID. So that kind of brought us back to Earth. But we had that sort of powerful emotional moment of realisation that we had done that thing. I would have felt that anyway, but having Wiggy there with me, it was much more powerful. It really, you know, kept me connected with the stupid job I found myself doing that year, because it was a pretty big year for me, 1984. It was a mad year.
I bet. And so that was like a marriage of ambitions then, sitting on the beach there.
Yeah, it was. Or a realisation of kind of youthful dreams, you know, the things that kept us going through all those years of, you know, knocking around in dead-end jobs and not being attractive to the local womanhood and not really, you know, having a social life. We had the band and the things we dreamed about the band doing, although we had absolutely no... idea how we would do them. Didn't come to pass as we expected, but they did in other ways.
Did you sort of sit there thinking, the atmosphere of America is so different from the UK that I'm going to tour here forever?
Well, I did realise that this was a completely different ball game to what I'd expected. I mean, you know, that trip, though, was such a watershed trip for me, because it was literally zigzagging across America on a coach. And the last 18 months notwithstanding, I've been to America on average twice a year for the last 35 years.
So it was.
There's some places on that trip I've never been to again. I don't even really know where the hell they were, but we were there and I have memories of that place. So I understood it was such a much bigger place.
Yeah.
And the possibilities were, if you could connect with the people there, were, you know, there's a possibility to have a long-term tour. And in the end, that's what I managed to do by going back and again and again and again. You know, I was fortunate at a time when college radio was strong. And yeah, so many of those college stations took their cues from the British music press. If you're on the cover of the NME or Melody Maker, you were in, and you were in good. And so I was very fortunate to be in that situation and to make that connection with an audience that are, you know, still interested in what I'm doing. I feel very fortunate in that sense.
Yeah, Americans in those early days just seemed to embrace the Englishness of what I guess you and I did. You know, I can remember on some very early tours of Squeeze, just being really surprised at the enthusiasm and the openness of the American fans.
Yeah.
Whereas the English fans in those days, just before the punk era, were a bit more reserved.
Yeah. Well, I was coming over in the middle of a miners' strike, singing "Which Right. Side Are You On?" and "It's Power and Union." And there weren't many people doing that in America at the time. So I, you know, although you're never going to crack the mainstream doing that sort of stuff, there's always going to be a significant minority who are looking for something a bit more, should we say, edgy, a bit more content over style, rather than the normal opposite, which is a normal thing in the mainstream. So I made some really good connections back then. You know, I kind of reminded people, whereas in the UK, people are likening me to a one-man clash, over there, they saw, you know, Woody. They started talking about Woody Guthrie. So I had to kind of get my head around that, because you didn't used to be able to buy Woody Guthrie records in the UK, certainly not where I lived. When I read in the first Bob Dylan biography that he was inspired by this guy, Woody Guthrie, I couldn't find his records anywhere. So it was only when I went to America, I mean, the joy of an American record shop, you must remember that first time you went in.
Very
and realised,
yeah,
what a treasury the average American record store is, that I was able to find Woody's records and realise what the connection is. And other people on tour opened my eyes to people like Phil Oakes and to Joe Hill and to Utah Phillips and other people who were, you know, making topical music, other than Bob Dylan, who was the most obvious person, the person I'd locked onto.
So as a lyricist, you were very drawn to that side of things.
Yeah, I was, yeah. The topical song aspect of things had always attracted me. And, you know, that's how I came back to, because, you know, when I was in a band, that was great and I really enjoyed that. But when it all fell apart, it was the idea, coming back to the idea to sort of perform on stage, that kind of excited me and, you know, was a challenge for me and scared me more than anything, that I wanted to try and do that. And that was because I'd listened to a lot of 60s singer-songwriters, you know, the idea of the one person on stage summoning up the spirit of the moment and having the right song. So that had always attracted me, you know. And also back then, I still believed that music could change the world.
Do you think that now?
No, I don't. I think it's more, it moves in mysterious ways, but it doesn't have agency. It can change your perspective of the world, and that's what I try and do for audiences. But more importantly than that, I think its real job is to make you feel that you're not alone. You know, I've come to the conclusion over the years that the currency of music is empathy. What we're trying to do, whoever we are, this is not a political thing at all, this is, you know, any songwriter, is trying to get the listener to empathise with the person in the song, to perhaps access feelings in a situation that the listener themselves has not experienced, and to relate to that in a compassionate way. Mm. Or the other way round, as an individual, to identify with the person in the song and draw some compassion from that by feeling that you're not alone. So that, you know, that feeling when you think the person who wrote the song has read your mail, that feeling is you realise that you're not the only person who's ever been this down. You're not the only person who's ever been this hurt. You're not the only person who's ever been in this ridiculous situation. And I learned that from Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. I wasn't the only person that had cried because my heart was broken. The tracks of my tears, you know. And so that aspect of what we do, the empathy, the compassion, that's the thing that has the seed of changing the world in it. Because it brings people together. There's a solidarity that you get from being at a gig and singing along to your favourite song with 1,000 other people and the person who wrote the song on stage. There's a solidarity there that is almost, you know, an emotional solidarity, I'm talking about here, not political. That's almost like communion.
It is, and I think that's what people have really missed in the last year and a half.
You can't get that shit. You can't get that shit online, you know?
You can't, no.
You can't.
Alongside our weekly guests, in each episode we'll be meeting other musicians from around the UK who've been supported by Help Musicians during these turbulent and troubling times. These beneficiaries are singers, songwriters, composers from rock and pop and classical, and they're all here to tell their story.
My name is Michael Kerr and I'm a full-time working musician and singer-songwriter from Belfast. So the likes of the Stone Roses and Oasis were definitely my catalyst to get into music, especially Oasis, more Noel Gallagher than Liam, which is why he brought me on to further influences like the likes of Bruce Springsteen, Tom Petty, Ryan Adams. So it's their fault really why I'm sitting here. I was a management consultant before I was a musician. I gave up career in the corporate world. I've been doing it for 10 years now. For me, the achievement was to make a living out of it, and I've been able to get that balance between working on the local circuit to earn your money and then going away to the likes of New Orleans and New York and other places to go and play your own music, you know. But over the pandemic, it's been pretty horrendous. I had trips to New York, Nashville, LA, all that's been cancelled. On top of that, I haven't been able to make a living on the local circuit because all the hospitality's closed, and to do it full time, you need to be doing at least 8 to 10 gigs a week. Most of all, I just haven't felt like a musician over the pandemic. When you get these things like, you know, just go and reskill, it's a real kick in the teeth, and maybe at the point of an exit strategy, to be honest with you. It just feels like we've been an afterthought for everything, and it's, you know, was it worth investing the past 10 years? You know, is it worth investing the next 10 years? Help Musicians have been great. I got one of the emergency funds, which is great, because that gave me sort of like a month's worth of money to sort of pay bills and sort of think about my next move in a more calm way. And they've got all those sort of things in place that if things do go really south, that you've got some there just to talk to, you know. Translation Fund is a fund if you want to develop a certain part of your skills. So if you want to go to a songwriting camp or you want to go to a certain music teacher. So I went to John Blatanya and me and him are working on songwriting performance. Help Musicians encouraged me to apply for it because I hadn't applied for anything through Help Musicians before because I hadn't really heard about them. John Blatanya was like the lead guitarist for Van Morrison for I think 30 years, so he played in sort of Moondance and all those great iconic albums and stuff. So I got to meet him and go up to his studio in Woodstock. I would definitely love to do a massive sellout gig. So my ultimate gig would be Belsonic, which is a festival in Belfast. If I got like a Belsonic or sold out a Waterfront Hall, you know, which holds a couple of thousand people, or an Ulster Hall. If I was able to do a gig as the headliner, you know, and sold it out, that'd be great.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. What was the first sort of artist that you saw that had that empathy and that it was delivered to you as a punter?
Live or on a...
Yeah, live.
Live. Yeah. I'd say Costello, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I was trying to learn my craft as a songwriter, he was probably my last jumping off spot before I became Billy Bragg. You know, I started off trying to write like Rolling Stones songs and Faces songs and Ronnie Lane songs, because that's who we were listening to, me and my mates. And then it's kind of like I graduated through the Eagles to Jackson Browne, and I wanted to be that kind of songwriter, and I tried to write like Jackson Browne. And then Elvis came along, and he, to me, was a revelation because he was Jackson Browne with a backbeat and an attitude and a chip on his shoulder. And I kind of liked that. I liked all that. So
I think you had more than one chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, he did, yeah. And unfortunately, that side of him, I kind of tried to avoid that. But he's not the sort of person you want to measure yourself against. You want to find someone human to measure yourself. Because Elvis ain't... I mean, I listen back to his records now that I now hear from the perspective of someone who's worked in the studio for 30, 40 years, which is not the perspective I had when I first heard Get Happy or Imperial Bedroom. And I now think to myself, just leave it. Don't do that extra. Don't need another vocal in a funny voice. Stop. It's a lovely song, you know. Because when you go and see him live, it's so raw. I heard him do I Want You once at the Royal Albert Hall. Oh, my God. Yeah. It would have peeled the wallpaper off your living room. It was so raw. It was so, so raw. Visceral. And that kind of thing you can't get. That's why I was happy when the Smiths came along, because I felt I could measure myself better against them.
Against them,
Elvis.
Yeah.
It's like never, you're never going to catch Elvis. He's like, you know, Leonardo da Vinci.
I was absolutely terrified when Squeeze went in the studio to record with him. He produced one of our albums.
Yeah.
And every day I would take the lyrics in and say, please, sir, can you look at my lyrics and tell me they're okay? You know, he was amazingly cool about it.
I'm sure. I mean, I've met him a couple of times and he's been really cool. The bar he set for himself.
The bar is set, yeah.
He's only for himself. None of the rest of it's not a bar and the rest of us can get over.
What about Kirsty when you were working with her? Because she was such an individual too, I think.
She was an amazing person to work with. And I had nothing but admiration for her. I'd been a big fan of her just before I got myself on the road. The last job I had before I gave up was working in a cutout record store. And one of the albums I fell in love with in that period was her Polygram record, which has got the chip shop on it. I can't remember the title of it now, but I really loved that record. So when she turned up one day wanting to record New England, I was flabbergasted. I was like, you know, because I wasn't just her voice I loved, it was her songwriting I really loved. So tweaking New England for her, and then she goes and has that fabulous hit with it, which is brilliant. But being in the studio with her, that was really good, because she just kind of came in and took charge. She just took charge of the session, whatever session she was on with me. She just told everybody what to do. She did a vocal, backing vocal, and then she'd say to the producer, okay, I'm just going to stand to one side now and do a slightly different one, do it, put it on this, put this tone on it, blah, blah, and then she'd do that. And she said, OK, I'm going to stand on another side now. I'm going to put this tone on it, do this, blah, blah. And then she said, right, that's that. Let's all go up to the pub.
She was lethal.
I've never worked with anyone like that before. And that's what was so great about her. The thing that I never understood is why she didn't want to play live, because people loved her. I did do a few gigs of her, and people absolutely loved her. And she just didn't have that self-confidence to go out there in front of an audience. And I think that was a really great shame, because performers need that support that you get from an audience. And you know, her version of New England has three verses, and I always sing the third verse when I play live now for Kirsty, and you know, my lot love it. And
what a sad loss. She was lovely. I only went round to her house once, and she made me stand on the coffee table and sing Call for Cats in the most Cockney accent I could possibly muster up, and I just found it humiliating. But you couldn't say no. Because you get slapped, probably.
Yeah. She was tough as old boots like that. Oh, yeah, she was amazing like that.
Yeah.
I was at a party at her house once, and someone I was talking to said, because she knew so many people. He said, you never guess who I've just seen? I've just seen Bob Hoskins. I said, oh, yeah. He said, don't know, he's coming over. He's coming over to talk to us. Don't look, he's coming, don't turn around. And I turned around, and it wasn't Bob Hoskins, it was Lionel Bart, which in some ways is more interesting, isn't it, than Bob Hoskins?
Much more interesting.
Nothing against Bob, I love his stuff. But as for a songwriter, to be able to say, you know, Lionel Bart's come to say hello to you, I was like, wow, you know.
What a thing.
A classic, you know, a skiffler as well, you know, original skiffler. For me, that's a real treat.
Yeah, absolutely. So over your long journeys, doing what you do, writing books, speaking publicly and writing songs, what would be one of the high points, one of the points that you sit down and just go, wow, that was amazing?
I was searching for some stuff that I might have to be able to sort of reference that, and I came across this backstage pass here. I don't know if you can see it there, but it just says on it, The Smiths, 12th February 1984, Lyceum. And what happened on that day was I did a gig at the Lyceum on a bill in between the Smiths and the Redskins. The Redskins were third on the bill. I was second, and the Smiths were top of the bill. And I had just vacated the number one spot in the independent albums chart to the Smiths' first album. Life's a Riot had been replaced by the Smiths' first album. And I was kind of just breaking out in a kind of national way. I think a week before I'd been on the cover of the NME. And in my mind, I was kind of pitching myself to be somewhere between the kind of radical strut of the Redskins, who were, you know, left-wing skinheads, members of the Socialist Workers' Party, and the kind of wry romanticism of the Smiths, and, you know, have that sharp dynamic and the tunefulness of the two bands. And I imagined myself to be somewhere between the two, like a Venn diagram of the two. And here I was physically in that place in that week. And I think that's when I finally realised I'd got that absolute key thing that you need in order to have a career. I was in the right place at the right time. I was right there in that moment. Boom, there it was. And kind of after that, you know, I'm into the miners' strike. I'm off to America. I'm defining myself in that left-wing sense in that year. 84, the miners' strike, Between the Wars comes out, all that kind of stuff. And so that was the moment where I think, you know, I was trying, pushing, and then that was where I realised I'd gone over the dam and I was on my way. So that was
amazing.
And the thing was, I knew it at the time. And that's the thing, because often those things happen, you look back and you think, oh man, you know.
So that's kind of like what they call the peak experience. It sort of happens without you planning it. It just turns up.
You find yourself there, yeah, and you look around yourself. You're in that position, you look around at the scenery, and you realise, yeah, you're where you're supposed to be. That's a good place to be in your life and in your career, that sense, to have that sense that you're in the right place, because then you feel you can take chances and you can, you know, push it a little bit.
And then conversely, what would be sort of one of the low points that you'd rather not go back to?
Well, oddly enough, the other thing I found was this little photocopied songbook I made when I was a rank Xerox key operator of lyrics for my old little band, Riff Raff. And it was when Riff Raff broke up, really, which would have been the end of 1980, where we kind of run out of rail and everyone, you know, the thing that I'd committed 5 years of my life to, that was going to be the thing that was going to save me from having to work at the Ford Motor Company in Dagenham.
Yeah.
That was coming to an end, and the guys that I'd relied on were going to different ways, and I understood why and all that. And I kind of ended up back at my mum's, sitting in front of the fire, eating cheese on toast, going nowhere. And I was in danger of becoming that guy down the pub who used to be in a punk band, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to take rather drastic action in order to press the eject button on my previous life. So I joined the Royal Armoured Corps.
My God, what a big thing to do.
Well, there was fuck all that was going on, really. It was like, I needed a complete change. You know, it seemed to me to be the best way to rid myself of the idea that I could ever do the job I'm doing now. To just, you know, go to the absolute opposite of what it was and send a signal to everybody that it's over, that it's finished, it's done with.
Makes you feel grateful, I suppose.
It was like, a clean break with everything that had gone before, and an attempt to start again as a different person with a different name in a different place with no baggage. And the trouble was, though, when I got to Catterick, where I was doing my basic training, I just was hugely inspired to write more songs.
Of course.
So I know it was a bit of a... I was hoping I'd kind of got rid of that when I got my hair cut, but sadly, or happily, rather.
Happily, indeed.
It was stronger. That impulse was stronger. So then I had to be like, oh, okay. So then I had to buy myself out of the bloody army and come back with a plan. And the plan was to go and play solo, because the army had given me the confidence to stand up in front of an audience and not be afraid of what might happen to me, because I felt, I'd done everything they asked me in the army and done it pretty well and been pretty good at it. And I thought, well, you know, if I can shit the British Army, I can certainly put up with an angry audience in, you know, Deptford on a Saturday night or whatever. It gave me the sort of confidence, I suppose, to be Billy Bragg, whereas before I'd been hiding behind a band and I'd been a bit, put my light under a bushel, and now I'm on my own, it's just me.
So brilliant, thank God for that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, I don't recommend it to everybody, joining the Royal Armour Corps, although you do get to drive a tank. There's not many jobs you can do that in. But it worked for me as a sabbatical, it really yeah. worked for me.
Yeah, when I was living on a council estate and I was with a bunch of boys, we were skinheads, and I met one of them at a gig about 5 years ago, and he said, you know what was weird about you is you'd always be sitting on the wall with a pencil and a pad writing poems while we were kicking the shit out of each other. And of course, that was the release for me. You know, I didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want that tension. I wanted to be a writer of some sorts, you know, but it wasn't respected.
No. No, well, and how would you do it? I mean, did you know any writers? I didn't know any writers. You know, how do you get from where you are, playing in your mum's back room, to playing at the Rainbow Theatre like the Clash are?
Yeah.
You know, and the thing about punk was, the revelation of punk was that you do it by doing it, you do it yourself.
Yeah, you learn by your mistakes, yeah.
That DIY attitude, I still live by that. You know, that's what punk was about to me. It wasn't about spiky hair and torn trousers. It was about a do-it-yourself attitude that says, if you want to write a history of skiffle, then write it. Go and you'll find someone to put it out. You'll get it out there somewhere, but do it yourself. Don't wait for someone to come along and say, here, any chance you could write me a book about the history of skiffle? Because no one's going to do that. In the end, it's your weird perspective on the world. You've got to have the confidence to put that out there and see what happens. Christ knows it's, you know, a kind of scary place now with social media, but it's always worth running up a flagpole to see who salutes it and who throws shit at it.
That's absolutely right. And help musicians who I'm sort of holding hands with here. I didn't really know a lot about, but it was started by Edward Elgar and Vaughan Williams 100 years ago.
Right, they were a great duo. I loved their early stuff.
I loved their early stuff as well. But one of their mates died in a railway accident, not sure quite how. His family couldn't afford to bury him, so they clubbed together, and that's how Help Musicians began.
Wow.
And there's always been a kind of empathy, you know, and a camaraderie for musicians sort of looking after each other. I wonder if that's true today.
Well, I'd like to think so. You know, I'd like to think that they're, you know, particularly where we are in the pandemic, not only about each other, but also about all the other people that we work with as well.
Our crew.
You know, from the crew to the, you know, the venue holders, you know, we're probably going to be the last people back. I mean, you know, I don't know about your audience, but I'm not sure my audience is going to be too keen on standing in a dark room with 500 people for 2 hours singing at the top of their voices until we're absolutely sure that this stuff is under some kind of control. So it may be a while before we all get back there, but I am confident that we will get back, and we've got to make sure that when we do, we're coming back in a way that kind of helps those people who found it really difficult the last few years. You know, I've had a few moments in the second lockdown where I did wonder if what I was doing would ever come back the way it was, or whether I was going to have to completely rethink what I was trying to do. You know, I had a few weeks where I really was wondering, where did I fit into things? And I kind of managed to focus that into songwriting. I'd been writing for a while, but the opportunity to make a record come along. And so I started, you know, thinking about how to articulate where my head was at in a way that wasn't straight ahead, you know, writing about the pandemic, but trying to look askance at it and come at it at a more emotional level. So that's the kind of album that I've made. And I'm hoping it resonates with people, but it certainly helped me to, you know, get my head around where I was and who I was and who I am now, because it's not the same, you know. Yeah. You'll know over a period of time, as you develop, the music industry changes, the scene changes, you change, and you have to be up to speed with that and not be constantly referencing back to where you was 20, 30 years ago.
So you found the songwriter, you were sitting in lockdown and the songwriter came back in the room.
Yeah, because I'd sort of been writing books the last couple of years as a means of refreshing myself after touring, because I really make money live touring rather than making albums. It's kind of secondary for me making albums. But getting off the road long enough to write a book was a way for me of clearing my head. And I was quite getting into it, you know, to the extent where I can sort of knock out a book now if you give me 6 months and a really something I really give a shit about.
Are you kind of like Randy Newman? You kind of put time aside, like 10 till 5?
For writing, book-wise?
Yeah.
Well, The first book, I just ran at it, and it was terrible. It's like climbing a mountain. But the second one, the Skiffle book, I got into writing between 3 and 5 and 6 and 8 every day, and having a break in the middle. And generally, I found I'd usually get away about 1,000 words. In the first couple of hours, I might not write much, but the second part, I'd usually got up to speed and I could get at it. So that worked for me. That really worked for me. And it also allowed me to engage with life and the family and everything. Because, you know, hiding yourself off at the bottom of the garden and not talking to anybody while you wrestle with George Orwell, which is what I was doing in the first book, you know, wasn't very conducive to family life. Whereas the other way, the couple of hours and the break in a couple of hours, that worked a lot better. But just as long as you're in a room with no Wi-Fi or phone. I was in my son's study in his bedroom after he left home. I parked myself up there far away from everybody, and that was kind of Skiffle Central.
But, of course, writing songs, it's a different inspiration. It comes from a different part of the spirit, doesn't it?
It is, and never the same way twice.
So never the same way.
Right. In that sense, you've got to be open to it. You've got to be, you know, I've always thought that songwriting is more about intuition than anything else. I don't know about you, but I find when I've got a project or when I'm making an album, I kind of tune into a frequency where the songs are, so that I'm in that headspace again. Because, you know, when I first, you know, when I was 25, I was in that headspace most of the time.
Sure.
Now, of course, I mean, I'd hate to be in the headspace I was when I was 25. Jesus, it would wear me out now. But, you know, to try and find that frequency again, to get back to that into that flow state where the songs are there, that's more how I write these days. I kind of... Yeah. I mean, I never was someone who was writing every day. I was one of those person who's, oh, shit, I've got a pill session tomorrow. I better write a couple of new songs.
Yeah.
And like that, I was always handing my homework in late. To some extent, that's still true because I was still writing songs right up to the last day in the studio. But, you know, there's so many different ways to write a song. And every single one of them, if the song gets written, every single one of those ways is the right way. There is no
absolute
one way.
There's no right or wrong way.
No.
Well, Billy, thank you so much for giving up your time. It's been wonderful speaking to you. It's so interesting to discover that, you know, the journey that we have as songwriters is very similar but different.
Yeah, that's the thing. And that's my sense about writing songs that really touch people. Although we have many different experiences, we all deep down inside have the same kind of feelings. And if you can get through those experiences and get to those feelings, then you have much more chance, not by writing a generalistic song, but writing the most personal song you can bear to write, you have a better chance of connecting with people. That's been my experience over the years.
Absolutely. Let's connect.
I meant that.
God bless.
All the best.
Thanks, Billy.
Cheers, man.
Well, it was a real treat talking to Billy Bragg on I Never Thought It Would Happen. He was so honest and open, and I just felt very at home talking to him. There was a lot of similarities in our journey, but some differences too. Like, I don't ever remember driving a tank. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.